Nice move by Steve Fisher here.
Welcome to the 19-9 podcast. We're back with Matt McLaughlin, and we're going to be talking about playing for the Mob. I'm going to just throw it to you because I wanted to hear why this. This came out in 2014, but I got to say, I loved it, so I'm not putting it down. I was super pumped to watch this. I hadn't actually watched it the first time, but what made you pick this? Let's start out there.
Oh, this is all of my passions combined into one. 1970s New York, Goodfellas, yeah. College basketball, and it's all, and you get to hear from Henry Hill himself. Yeah. And it's narrated by Ray Liotta. Yep. Fantastic touch. And I think that Playing for the Mob is one of the best 30 for 30s that's ever been put out. The problem is that people don't realize how much of a powerhouse Boston College was back in the day. And it's also like the modern day, the closest thing that college sports has seen, or sports have seen as a whole, since the 1919 Black Sox scandal. And because it's a team that's involved with this, and granted, the history now and what really happened is kind of murky, just because different people have different perspectives on how meetings operated and stuff like that. But the general consensus is that three players, Jim Sweeney, Rick Kuhn, and Ernie Cobb, were all either one indirectly or directly contributing to point shaving during the 1978 to 79 season. Now, the FBI never really gathered enough evidence to suggest that point shaving was taking place. But throughout the documentary, Sweeney testifies meetings that Kuhn and him had with like gangsters. It's not like the Lucchese crime family or anything, but it's like, it's just,
it's close enough.
Yeah, it's Henry Hill. It's the original, yeah. It's the OG Goodfella. And it's so many different things of like true crime, basketball, and scandal, and gambling all rolled into one. And I think that this needs its love. And so I wanted to take this chance to give it its love. Cameron Cran, Joe Levine, they're two of the directors on this project. Fantastic job.
Oh, man.
Absolutely fantastic job with the storytelling and the yes. pacing and everything like that. So I wanted to give this a shout out. Also, shout out to Bruce Pearl. This was early Bruce, like pre-Auburn yeah. Bruce Pearl.
Yeah.
So shout out to Bruce Pearl.
Seriously.
Apparently a student aide there.
Yeah, just a student aide recalling some light shenanigans going on the team back then. Yeah, so let's start it with Boston College, because I think that's some important context there. Like, why should anybody care about Boston College? Because now, it's crazy how some of these Big East teams who were powerhouses have just sort of fallen into, you know, just irrelevance.
Oh, it's absolutely sad. And Boston College is definitely one of those schools. My Georgetown Hoyas yeah. have taken a complete fall off in the last plus. Still upset about that Florida Gulf Coast upset. Oh, I remember crying that night seeing that final score. But yeah, it's unfortunate. At Boston College, they've had some decent programs. They had, I think it was 2018, 2019, when they had Kai Bowman and Jerome Robinson yeah. in that backcourt, upset number one Duke on their home floor. Awesome moment. But it does kind of speak to how much college basketball has evolved over the years since this scandal took place, and how exponentially, like, number one, how much money these programs have made since this scandal took place, and how much these programs have invested into their facilities or whatever it may be. Since that time. And also, it kind of took me back to a time when inner city rivalries meant so much more.
Yeah.
Like, you have BC Harvard, you have, yeah. like, and I'm a Philly guy, so LaSalle U versus UPenn, or LaSalle U versus Temple.
Yeah.
Even Temple versus Nova had some decent moments, but I wish that college basketball had that again, and they'll never have that again, unfortunately, because it's only going to expand more, and you'll have the Duke-UNC rivalries. You'll have, you know, some of the other notable rivalries around the nation, but those inner city matchups, I think, meant so much more because there was so much bragging rights within like your area of home
yeah.
that it was so special. And now it kind of sucks, but at the same time, you get to see like, imagine Zion gets dropped on in this, like, BC-Harvard game. Like, he would be a dinosaur compared. Oh, like, gosh. And I mean that, like, physically. He would yeah. look like a dinosaur compared to compared to these
guys. I'll be honest. I watched him last night. He looks like a dinosaur even on the court.
Ben Simmons the way he looks goes like through. Swiss cheese. What's happening? Guarding him. Yeah. I understand the Victor Wembanyama hype.
Yeah.
And my co-host, Black and Blue Pod, like, comment, subscribe, all those good things. Black and Blue Pod on all audio platforms. Shameless plug.
For sure.
But my co-host, Timmy, he made a really good point, I think last week when we recorded. Why don't we pump the brakes on Wembanyama as, like, the greatest prospect ever? Because we hadn't seen Zion in a year. Yeah. We hadn't seen him up until last night.
Yeah.
And
felt good to have him back.
Oh, it's awesome. Give me point Zion, please. And the Pelicans are going to be awesome this year. They got some really good depth that I'm very excited about.
Yeah.
And Zion, I think half of his shot chart, if not more, was just in the layups, just cutting off ball and just spinning or doing putback layups. It was fantastic. Loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that goes back to the 1970s style play because they've got no 3-point line. So it's all interior.
Also, the funky jump shot form.
Jump shot, for sure.
These coaches were teaching some Jamal Wilkes type shit.
It's no, they like, weren't. That's the thing. They weren't teaching. You don't realize, like, no one taught you your jump shot. There was no, like, shot doctor or, you know, a coach that you went to. It was just, like, you in the play. Or maybe you go to the playground and some dude there is like, yeah, shoot it like this. And you're like, okay. And then I remember I shot with, like, two hands until – middle school, and then someone's like, don't do that. And I was like, really? Oh, okay. I guess I did it. No. And then all of a sudden I was like, yeah, this works way better with one hand, you know? Exactly. There wasn't the investment in it. And that goes to the money. It goes to the money that was involved too. But let's paint the picture of Kuhn, because I think he was probably the, you know, everything sort of centered around him. So what in the world? Like, this guy was just such an interesting character. Like, just paint the picture of this dude who the documentary kind of centers around. He's like the go-between.
Yeah. So Rick Kuhn acts as like the go-between between the mafia and the other players. And for people to get an image of what Rick Kuhn like looks like, imagine a souped up Tom Selleck.
Yes.
Like, that's basically what Rick Kuhn looks like. And he was a guy that had a chance with the Cincinnati Reds to in the majors, but blew his arm out in the minor league. So he goes to Boston College, switches to basketball, where he looks like a grown man compared to everyone else, of course. And he acts as the go-between between Jim Sweeney, Ernie Cobb, and the guys in the associated with the mob that were organizing the bets and organizing how much money was going to which player, et cetera. And so what would happen is the mafia guys would bet the money. If the Boston College players kept the score within the spread that they bet, the profits would, some of the X percentage of profits would be given to Kuhn. Kuhn would distribute that amount of money to the players, whether he'd split it like 25, 25, and he would keep the other 50. And he's a guy from Pittsburgh that just kind of like, for whatever reason, whenever I watch this documentary, I think he makes mistakes, but for whatever reason, I keep like pulling for him.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what it is about him, but I always, for whatever reason, I've watched this documentary so many times and I love it every time I watch it.
The mustache, maybe? I don't know.
It's got to be the mustache, something. Like, I don't get what it is. And he, for whatever reason, I just keep saying, like, come on, Rick, you can do it. Keep going. Yeah. Just say no. And then it's like, oh, wait, we're back to where we are.
Well,
and
clearly he's charismatic because he ropes in Sweeney. Sweeney's like his you know, best buddy. And, you know, he seems like a guy that the other guys like, which makes sense, right? He's had a little more life experience. He's, you know, being a professional baseball player at some level. So you could see how, like, younger college guys would gravitate to a guy like that. And he must have been a hell of an athlete to just be like, oh, I blew out my arm, I'm going to go play Division I college basketball now. No big deal. Like, that's,
oh, no, not
that's
at some all.
Incredible, like, athleticism. And he's not, like, end-of-the-bench guy either, fixing this stuff up. Like, he's in the game. Like, he's playing.
He's a full-time starter. Yeah. And also, we're talking about eligibility rules now.
Yeah.
I want to know what these eligibility rules were back in the day where he could just switch to basketball. Yeah.
He's like, well, you know, he hadn't used his basketball eligibility. He's just been baseball.
Apparently not. Yeah. Apparently not.
Boston College in the 70s, a little bit different.
Boston College. And then Kevin Mackey, assistant coach.
Is that real? Is that a real accent?
Oh, 100%. I believe in my heart of hearts. That's where we were going, to the top, baby. We were going to the top. I saw a great effort from our guys to really win the game there. Boston accents definitely rank in the top three for me.
Yeah. So he sets up this meeting with Sweeney, and they go to this hotel room. This is where the Goodfellas character Henry Hill comes in, and they meet him there, right? And yeah, I was trying to figure out. I don't know if you looked into this, and do you know why Kuhn wasn't in the documentary? I was trying to figure out if he was even still alive afterwards.
But so I didn't know. He kind of disappeared.
They had some video footage of him though, speaking.
He started doing public speaking engagements at college programs, I think, after, just to kind of help these kids understand that, like, be more responsible, obviously, and just be careful of the people that you surround yourself with. And with Kuhn and Sweeney, they meet Henry Hill and the Perla brothers. The Perla brothers know Rick Kuhn, and Kuhn gets connected through the Perla brothers to Paul Maisie. Paul Maisie met Henry Hill in prison, and Paul Maisie, since he knows Kuhn through the Perla brothers, connects Henry Hill with Kuhn to create this whole scheme.
Yeah.
And that's when Hill has the connections to Jimmy Burke, who's played by Robert De Niro in Goodfellas.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And so that's where the majority of the money comes in. And so that's how, like, they get more money to keep gambling. The more money they win gambling, they split it with the players, and it goes on down the line. And so this meeting, Jim Sweeney, I've had a chance to talk to him. Really awesome dude. A fantastic speaker. All around great guy. And I feel terrible for him because he was just a college kid scared that got wrapped up into this whole situation. In that meeting with Hill and the Perla brothers, Hill is like patting him on the back, and he thinks that he's just kind of being a nice guy, but he's like patting him down for a wire.
Oh, yeah,
and eventually it comes full at Sweeney. Hill like reveals the plans for the scheme, and Sweeney just says yes, just out of fear. And there are a couple of times where he's about to tell someone, and he just gets too intimidated because either Hill makes implied threats or just explicit threats.
Yeah.
and so he's just kind of this college kid just wrapped up in the situation, and he just wants to graduate and get out.
Yeah.
And so he kind of gets wrapped up in this. Ernie Cobb, an interesting character in this one though,
because
he doesn't necessarily admit that he admits that what he would have done at when they filmed this, he was 50 years old. He was like, what I would have done at 50 is a different decision than I would have been at 16 to 20 years
right.
old. Because he gets an envelope of $1,000 for, they lost the game against, I believe it was Providence, or maybe Holy Cross or something. And he didn't know what it was for, but he didn't question it. He got it from the Perla brothers because they were under the assumption he was in on it too. And he was the team's leading scorer, only posted about like 10 to 12 points that game.
Yeah.
And so he admits in the documentary, I'm not going to question $1,000. Give it to me. And it's like, it's kind of startling because it's like you get this take from Sweeney that he knows it's wrong. He just doesn't want anyone to get hurt. And he's kind of like this white knight in shining armor, I should say, in the story that's just trying to figure out the situation and do the best they can. But Cobb is just like, no, this is reality. I grew up from not a really good family. I'm trying to get to the NBA. I don't even really have enough money to like eat some of the times, college athletes, we've heard stories about college athletes really struggling financially.
Yeah.
And so he kind of admits like, no, I need the money. It's the most realistic take in throughout the whole documentary. It's very startling, which is why I like it. Cause it's kind of like to connect it to Goodfellas, the cocaine helicopter scene where it's just like, wait, this isn't what this is. As a viewer, I'm like, this isn't what's supposed to be happening. You guys are supposed to be having like great family barbecues and everyone's throwing down either drinks and choking down cigars. And like, this was a good time. What happened?
Yeah.
And that was on purpose. And so That's a very similar moment in this documentary. That was a weird.
The best part about this documentary is that Henry Hill was actually having his cocaine moment at this moment too. That's part of the reason he's like losing control of situations like this, where he's trying to just dabble in everything. Because this is right around the time that the heist at the airport goes down. They actually kind of include that in there.
As a loop in.
I thought that Bowie was an interesting character too, playing sort of the angel on the shoulder of these guys. Like, you need to go tell, coach, you need to tell someone. And he gets implicated, which, man,
sucks.
It's tough. It's tough, because you're thinking as a journalist, you want to get it right, and you use a source that you trust, and, What do you do? And who knows? Like, who is in the conversation? Like, what is? This is such a weird situation. Like, what is involved? Like, you're new Sweeney's. You knew about the situation. You didn't tell anyone. You told him to maybe tell a coach. But I don't know. It is an odd situation. Like, where does your responsibility begin and end? Right.
Exactly. And with Bowie, it's like he was the starting at 3 or 4, mm-hmm. and. I think what makes it worse is that I don't want to go into detail about this, but the history of Boston just racially, that's what kind of makes it worse in my mind, especially.
Interesting.
Just because it's like, okay, if this happened to Ernie Cobb, would they have retracted it? Would the situation have played out differently because he's the leading scorer on the team, leading them to a lot of wins? Not saying that was the case. Maybe it was just an honest mistake, but I think a lot of times, and in general, in the pop culture, and in this case specifically, a city like Boston, I think at that time in history, they did not really care to check the facts and verify everything. I think they just kind of assumed that, oh, yeah, it's Bowie. That makes sense because, for a reason that I won't go down that path. But, and I give Bowie a lot of credit. Oh my God. Credit. That my brain just
midterms.
Didn't work there. Yeah, seriously. English midterms already. I give him a lot of credit for actually being the one so far that we know of in this documentary that actually poked the bear and said, like, what are you guys doing? Like, what's going on here? And he makes a good point. An athlete should be able to talk to if it's not the head coach, it can be the athletic director. It should be able to be an assistant coach. So a teammate, someone. You got to have someone. And unfortunately, the one guy that Sweeney could talk to about it, Kuhn, was involved in it with him. So it's like he felt like he was just a dog in a corner and nowhere to go, which I can't even imagine being in this type of situation.
So I want to, just as we start to close out here, I wanted to like bring it back to the present day, because had me really thinking about college basketball and today, and just today's college athletes, because it's so different. Like, betting now is as normal as, crazy, right? Like, there's so many bets. So my concern is, like, is this already happening way more than we actually know? Because you can bet on players' point totals. You can bet on anything now. So, I mean, it's different when it's, like, just the line, and you could almost, like, the FBI still couldn't figure out if they actually affected it or did anything. But now there's no way they could figure it out. So it just makes me think, like, oh, maybe this would be way easier to pull off now, and maybe it's happening more than I even realize.
I think the difference between now, though, is that there are safer areas. Like, they're just safer ways to bet, period. Because you can just, like, why would someone go through the hassle of convincing a top prospect to shave points intentionally to get a bigger payout where they can just open up their phone and go on FanDuel or go on DraftKings or go on MGM or whatever and just place a $20 bet or whatever.
I mean, I guess it's the other end of that though, right? Because, the problem for me, I don't really bet on college athletics because it's so unpredictable. It's weird to place bets on it. But if you had an assurance, you could bet, put a large bet on it. And so,
but also that's for all the criticism that it's gotten, this is the good thing about NIL. And I remember in eighth grade or seventh grade writing a paper on why athletes should get paid because of this documentary. Like, I watched this documentary and then wrote a paper on why they should get paid. And so this is the good side of the coin for NIL, is that the athletes aren't nearly as reliant on these sketchy characters, and they can actually like get their own income just through their own. Like, who was the guy for St. Peter's?
Yeah.
Doug.
Yeah. With like Dougie Mustache. Another mustache coming through.
Another mustache guy. Dougie Mustache. Yeah, for guys like him, and even at the top tier programs, those guys are going to be even more critical moving forward. And getting NIL, that's going to be the biggest bonus, is that these athletes can't be so vulnerable to these type of characters.
Well, see, I might be being too galaxy brain about this, but what if that helps the gambler even more too? Because now they can be even more separated from it. So you could get and give a player an NIL deal. So it's not even for, you know, you have an off the books conversation about, hey, we're going to shave some points here. But the payout isn't cash, you know, through Western Union. It's NIL deal that's totally legitimate. So now you've like legitimized it, but the relationship could still be dirty. And I'm not thinking about the bigger players, because I think it would be harder with like the bigger athletes, like you said, because they're going to get more money and they don't want to risk that. But I'm thinking about like the guys at Boston College who aren't everybody's going to get big enough NIL deals to make a difference. I mean, these guys are doing this for $2,500. I mean, I don't know what it would be today to make a guy do it, but it still probably wouldn't be that much, considering like maybe how much you could make off a certain bet. So I don't know.
I don't think so, just because the reality is that college sports, no matter the level, have turned into semi-professional sports. And so now these athletes more than ever are educated on financial awareness and the importance of your image. And these are kids that have been playing AAU since they were 5, 6, 7 years old. And so they've had this idea of being in the NBA or whatever it is since they can remember. And so I think it's harder for a gambler to convince them to risk that dream. Now, depending on the kid, you may be right. This may be happening and you get a kid who's desperate enough. I mean, we can see how quickly a career can change. Look at the Imani Bates situation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
like
wow.
a career can just, in a dime, in an off season, when they get surrounded by the wrong people at the wrong time, a situation can just turn quickly. And I just think that now it's much more difficult. And I think that the typical gambler doesn't necessarily want to go through that and risk that, especially when it's like, you know, in the documentary, it's like basically like a RICO trial.
Yeah,
like
it is.
And
they like, didn't even know it either. Henry Hill.
Yeah. Like, talk about RICO.
Talk about just like being honest. He's like, I'll be honest, I didn't even know that was a crime. Like we're just like murdering people and stealing stuff from airports. I'm like, you mean I can't bet on college sports? Like,
yeah. And I think it's just a different type of atmosphere. And you can bet on college sports, obviously, but I think that the typical gambler is just going to open up their app and be like, all right, I'll take Duke with the spread plus, you know, whatever player over points. Like, I think it's just easier to do that. And obviously no one wants to go through a RICO case, I would imagine. I haven't met anyone that says, you know what, I need in my life a RICO case.
Maybe if you're the prosecutor, he seemed to be having the best time with that.
Oh, like he was loving life.
He's like, I am making my career right now. Keep going, Henry Hill.
Yeah. Cause Henry Hill, like I know in Goodfellas, I ran into this issue, but kind of like conundrum. When I was fortunate enough to interview Jim Sweeney for my podcast, and he brought up a good point that in a previous podcast, I, you know, shared my love for Goodfellas. And he said that, you know, he just wanted to push back on the romanticization. Mm-hmm. I think that's English.
That's right.
Of the mob, the beginning of that movie did for like the Italian mafia and the perception of it. what we have to keep in reality that these were terrible human beings. Mm-hmm. These are terrible human beings that did they get dealt a bad hand in life? Yes. And did they do some bad things? Absolutely. And in the good and the bad that came with it. Mm. And it's like, I remember watching Goodfellas and being like, why can't this be my life? Like, why can't I? Not like the crimes and stuff. Not the crimes
specifically
and stuff,
just, the cocaine and the helicopters.
Exactly. The cocaine and helicopter. I was like, that's my job.
Gosh, can we make that happen?
Exactly. 19-9 sponsors. Yeah. But like the family gatherings, the gravy, right. The family's over. And it's like, oh, this is amazing. And you forget that these are mobsters that are committing crimes and but they did what they had to do to survive. So it's like this weird, like it's this weird balance of like what's good, what's not. And it's important to remember that Henry Hill, for as charismatic as he is coming across screen, mm-hmm. it's important to remember the things that he did, both good and bad, in his life, and that we shouldn't necessarily look up to those type of people as like who we aspire to be. If I articulated that point properly, I hope I did.
I think you did. I mean, it certainly doesn't come off like that in the movie either. I mean, even Coon gets 10 years in prison. I mean, that's a rough sentence. I'm sure that
and that's 15 minutes in. Like they tell you how this is going to end pretty much 15
he's like,
minutes
oh
in.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that's a brutal for a guy who's 20 years old, I mean, or 22, whatever he was, you know, to be handed that, you know, to start your life with basically is just, you know, and I understand that he made his own decisions, but the strangeness of his involvement was difficult. And then to have all those other guys too, just knocked down. I think that is something that I'm hopeful your statement about guys hopefully not getting caught up in this anymore, that people have realized the amount of supports that college athletes need and they just provide them with more. You know, I remember talking to Jesse Washington about John Thompson and how he would follow his players around Washington, D.C., and how he had to talk to the guys who went and, you know, were meeting with one of the gang leaders in D.C. He's like, you can't do that anymore. You know, like he's waiting for them himself, the head coach, like, because he didn't have anybody else to do that. Like he's following them to bus stops. Like there are just so many more layers of insulation for the players now and more hands to help the players out that I hope that even if they couldn't go to the coach, that they would have someone else that could guide them before they got so deep into it. Because, you know, once you've accepted the money, and there are just layers to it. The meeting is one layer. The money is another layer.
How many stories have we heard?
The not telling, you know, just saying, hey, there they are in the – you know, they're there, they're showing up to games. Like you just be like, these dudes are here. They're going to murder me if I don't like throw the game right now. Like that's crazy. Right.
Exactly. And it really comes down to the coach creating that type of environment that the players can be safe. And like, how many stories have we heard of guys getting the duffel bag and, or just getting a garbage or a grocery bag full of cash.
Yep.
And now with NIL, a coach can safely like say like, hey, you're gonna make money here, and now that's more out in the open, it's safer for the player.
That's fair.
To prevent, to like get that shield around them. And I'm glad you brought up John Thompson, because John Thompson, although he did not win as many you know, Dean Smith or Bobby Knight or some of these other coaches, I think it's important to remember this, the cultural impact that he had and the impact that he had on his players as a guy that was a strong black man who was not afraid to do what it took for his players to feel safe around him and do what was best for his players as human beings first and foremost before getting to the professional level, if they could get to the professional level. I mean, classic example, Allen Iverson. Mm-hmm. Allen Iverson was in a butt ton of trouble before he got to Georgetown.
Yeah, coming out of jail.
Exactly. And he transforms. Granted, he had his issues in the NBA, but he transforms into one of the great, most beloved players in NBA history.
For sure.
And that's where the coach really makes their mark. That's why you could put some blame on Tom Davis, the Boston College coach, in this situation for basically trying to push out Jim Sweeney by trying to bring in recruits and transfers and try and get Jim Sweeney out of the lineup. But Sweeney just consistently kept playing well. And it's on the coach, and it should be on the assistant coach to pull him aside and say, like, hey, are you all right? Is everything all right at home? What's going
on? Well, he's definitely not following them to the bus stop like John Thompson was, because these guys are going to hotels and meeting up with gangsters. So a little more awareness, right?
Very few people were doing what John Thompson
was doing. I know. I mean,
It's like what – I don't know if you ever saw the U documentary when Howard Schnellenberger would do that in Miami.
Yeah, exactly.
Like he would go into Overton and all these bad neighborhoods in Florida, and it's like, Joe Paterno would never do any of that shit. Lou Holtz ain't doing any of that shit. And John Thompson, he probably one of the most respected coaches of all time. And so he can command that respect.
Yeah.
And you know he's not taking any of that. John Thompson ain't taking anyone's crap.
Oh no.
So he's the one guy with the gall and the reputation to do that.
Oh yeah, he the best part of that story is afterwards he had that same guy into his office. So he calls the gang member into his office, and he's like, and has a conversation with him. Like, this guy was like feared in DC, and he's like, you need to come to my office, talk to me, you know, like he's like power played him, and it worked too. The guy stepped away, let him, I mean, he's a fan. So, you know, again, some of these guys, even with their warts, you know, I don't doubt like that these guys probably loved BC basketball. And if they would have known like the trouble they were going to get these young guys into, they might've stepped aside. So that's a, you know, possibility too, if they somebody would just told them, you know.
And last point about John Thompson, I'm a Georgetown fan, so I'm geeking out right now talking about John Thompson. But he says after the 1980 championship game in the post-game media scrum that I think it was 1980, it was when they won. The reporter asked, like, how does it feel to be the first African-American coach to win a national title? He's like, I don't care whether I'm black, red, yellow, polka dotted or not. Saying that implies that an African American is not smart enough to win a national championship, and we disprove that point.
Yeah.
And so that's that quote. I didn't quote that exactly, obviously. Now I'm going to have to order the John Thompson memoir.
You should.
I got to get it now.
Get it and talk to Jesse Washington, who goes right. I think they're going to do a documentary on that too. So we can do that sometime too. He's going to work.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So John Thompson, that's the type of guy that he was. And Ewing talks about how much Thompson protected them and all those guys. And I wish there were more coaches like John Thompson around, because now it just feels like certain coaches are just leeches and just lurk in the corner and just pounce on recruits.
There's a lot of money. It's the money, you know, like he did it for the passion. So many of these coaches like then came up through the high school ranks and, you know, coaching at little, you know, rec leagues and stuff like that. And there's just so much money involved in protecting their corners now. They work for the shoe companies more than they work for as much as they work for the school sometimes. So,
oh yeah, exactly. Like if anyone watches, maybe we should do that one, that one next, Requiem for the Big East.
Let's do it.
Like the various coaches in the Big East at the time basically openly admit, like, not how much they were making, but that it was enough that it became a bigger part of their lives than the basketball aspect of it. And like, unfortunately, that's just the reality of college sports right now.
Yeah.
But let's not end on a sour note.
I think that can be a positive. I mean, how pumped are you for the start of the season? It's right.
I'm pretty
the corner.
Pumped. So I'm optimistic about Georgetown.
This is the season for optimism.
It is the season. Hey, I'm a Philly fan. I'm feel euphoric.
Yeah.
This past weekend.
Yeah. Right.
I felt like it was better than any drug that I could be taken. But Georgetown, I'm optimistic about. I think that Ewing is figuring out, especially after the conference tourney run a couple of years ago, I think he's figuring out the right personnel for him. And also the Big East, I'm not necessarily scared of the Big East, especially Villanova doesn't have Jay Wright.
Yeah.
Villanova, great program.
They're going to miss him.
They're going to miss Jay Wright. Like St. John's. Okay. Like I'm supposed to be scared of Thad Matta coming back to Butler. Like that's just not going to happen.
As an IU fan, you might want to show some fear for him. He smoked us for a long time there at Ohio State. Although Butler's a little different than Ohio State, I think.
Probably.
Yeah.
But Big East does not necessarily scare me right now. Will I be saying that come December? Probably not. I'll probably be two and seven.
Woo! You stay onto that. Hang on to that confidence. What about IU? Are they gonna win the Big Ten this year or what?
I mean,
tell me something happy.
I mean, I've heard a lot of hype about Indiana.
I know they've had a lot of hype.
Indiana's getting a lot of hype, and you know, Woodson's got something.
Yeah,
I think he's really got something. I think he's bringing passion and energy back to the fan base.
Yeah,
that really has been lacking there for a long time, and I think they needed. Granted, I don't know IU's coaching history, but I feel like they haven't had a Bobby Knight protege come in with the same level of passion, but just be less of a dick.
Yeah.
So
they haven't had that. He's got a presence, like the way he carries himself. And I think maybe that's the NBA, going to the NBA, coming back to college. He has a certain gravitas that maybe some of the other guys, they seemed to, well, first Crean needed to like almost seem like he needed it too much, where he was like appealing so much that it went too far at times. And then it seemed like, you know, after that, it just, I don't know. Like he just lost the grip on it. And then Miller, I don't know if he wanted to be there. He was kind of like the big man in the NBA who's like is in the NBA because he's tall, but doesn't actually want it. So I don't know if he actually even wanted it, or if he just, it was just like, I can't pass up, you know, a Big Ten, you know, offer basically.
Yeah, exactly. And Iowa, Iowa, I think, takes a step back, and just because they finally, I think they've officially lost everyone from like the Luka Garza years after like 7 years. Together,
I know. I don't want to talk because Trace Jackson Davis, it feels like he's been there for forever. Everyone's going to be like, man, how long has he been there for?
Yeah, seriously. I'm at Penn State right now. Penn State could put something together. I like their guards. I think Miles Dredd is going to have a big year. And I think that they could catch a couple of teams by surprise, go a little bit above. I love Shrewsbury. Michael Shrewsbury, I think, has been a great hire as a coach, just because
interesting.
Very similar to the Mike Woodson vibe, mm-hmm. very energetic, very passionate. And I think he really is interested in building Penn State as a program. Will he stay here around for the long term? I have no idea, obviously, but wouldn't surprise me if he bounced after 4 years-ish and goes to the NBA and tries there, which I don't blame him. I don't blame him. Go ahead, do what you got to do. Go like the Mike Brown route and just
– if that's your goal, you should.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So with all that being said, I mean, Ohio State, they lose EJ Liddell. I'm looking around the Big Ten. Michigan – this is really going to be a prove it year for Juwan Howard.
Like, yeah, seriously. I think a lot of guys.
I think
he's got his big
Dickerson
man still.
Returns, right?
Yeah.
Hunter Dickerson's coming back. And I think that like he's been such an anomaly as the alumni or alumnus that comes back and coaches the team to success that I really want to see was that deep run a few years back. Is that real or was that just the talent that you had on the roster that year? I think he's got a lot to prove. And also, don't slap anyone. That would be nice. Don't slap another coach.
Yeah,
maybe.
Well, you know.
Maybe. We'll see. It's Juwan Howard.
He was Will Smith before Will Smith, or Draymond Green before Draymond Green.
He was doing what Draymond did before Draymond.
He just didn't have the podcast.
He was part of the Fat Five for a reason. Yeah. So.
He's done a great job, and he has that kind of similar gravitas. It feels like it's his job. He'd have to lose the job rather than, you know,
you're going to have to kill Juwan Howard.
Right?
You're going to have to kill Juwan Howard.
Or he'll have to get an NBA offer or something like that.
Yeah, and I think he's really enjoying Michigan. But, you know, anything can happen. And, yeah, Indiana, if there's any year, this is the year.
This is it?
Kind of similar to Georgetown when I was talking about in the Big East. I think Indiana could really put something together. I think they've got the right talent. I think Mike Woodson is a great coach at the college level. At the NBA, that's a different discussion. But, and I think Indiana could – the Hoosiers could make some serious noise. I think that this is – the days of Iowa and Michigan running the Big Ten, I think, are coming to a close. And I think the Hoosiers, that this could be a Hoosiers revival.
Oh, we're, I'm excited. We're ending on that for sure.
I'm excited. Well, hey, I mean,
Illinois, cut the reel.
Seriously, that's IG reel clipping. Yeah. And I'm excited to see what Illinois does too. I think Illinois is a, I love Underwood. I think that they've got some real scrappy guys. Losing Kofi Coburn.
Maybe it helps them though. That's the one thing I'm worried about with IU too. Is like we're still got the you know big guy, which he's going to be awesome, but can't shoot. You know the can't shoot big guy is just is tough in the modern basketball. Like you have to figure it out around him, and that's not always easy.
Yeah, not. I think this will be the first year where I think Underwood wants to play how he wants to play, with like a lot more spacing, shooting, moving the ball around, and just. Maybe more versatility.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to help out Illinois a lot more in the Big Ten rather than like force feeding Coburn down low. And it kind of felt like, all right, we're just playing this way because Coburn decided to come back and we kind of got to like keep him happy for now.
Yeah.
And also not having DeSomu. I think at that point last year, like people were just kind of ready to close a chapter on that book on those, that DeSomu Coburn year. And it was
how are they not better? DeSumo's awesome on the Bulls. Like
he's awesome, but credit to Loyola Chicago, man. They figured out a way to smother that offense. I had Illinois going to, I think I had them winning all.
I did too. That was the year I was like, I think they're going to win the title. Those two guys.
Exactly. Awesome. And Loyola Chicago is like to college basketball, what Iowa is to football.
They pull
off these upsets out of nowhere and it makes no sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, Illinois and Indiana, I think, would be my top two contenders for the Big Ten this year.
I'll take it. I like it. All right, we'll do Rec Room for the Big East for our next one.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Let's do it. I'll check in. Thank you for listening to the 19.9 Podcast. If you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, make sure you do. And while you're at it, leave us a rating or review. 5 stars only, like the basketball camp. We also have links to all of 19.9 social media so you never miss a release. Until next time.